Today is Wednesday, July 31st. Today's session is entitled A Forum on the Environment. What car are you driving these days? Is global warming an ethical issue for U.S. Christians? What can Holden do? It is number FO2002-34. Let's listen in.
Comments from several people who sort of volunteered to say one or two things, but then what the purpose of Forum at Holden is really to open up to all of you and hear your ideas, what you're working on in your life. This is everybody's chance to bat ideas around here, and we'll take about an hour or maybe just 45 minutes, however the conversation seems to be going, and try to get a chance to hear from everybody who wants to say something. But why don't we start with who? Harry looks like he's about to fall asleep, but really he's not. Is Holden's utilities manager, and he'll say something. Then Norman Hovel, who's been teaching this week on letters to the earth, will say a couple things. Then Terry Buckholz, an environmental engineer who was at Holden Lake today, but I thank you for coming back and being willing to say a little bit. And then Phil Note, who has been teaching this week on global warming. And then Rich, who's also with the whole utility, works with Harry. And then all of you are welcome to become experts on this topic. I was just going to say, Phil had a really, really sobering fact in the talk today, and it hadn't dawned on me. He said, if carbon dioxide doubles, as it definitely will, we do lose all the glaciers, except in Antarctica, even if we stop the increase by 2050, it looked like on that one chart, which means there won't be any glaciers in Copper Basin. There won't be any glaciers feeding Holden utilities. So why don't we start with Harry? He'll tell us where we'll be getting our power from.
I don't know where we'll be getting our power from. Our power will be more seasonal. We're directly dependent upon our water, or both our drinking water and the water we use to generate electrical power. Most people think comes from Railroad Creek, but it actually comes from Copper Creek out of Copper Basin. It's basin right behind us. And there's a diversion dam. There's no reservoir. It diverts water into the flume, and penstock is about two-thirds of the way up to the basin. And it is fed by the initial snowmelt, and then during the late summer and fall by the melt coming off the two glaciers hanging on the side of Copper Peak and Mount Furneaux behind it. Our electrical production is extremely seasonal here. In the summer, unit number one will generate up to 300 kilowatts, and that's what's keeping us going now. It just has plenty of water since there it spins. But in the winter, when the flow drops off, 2 years ago we were down to about 33 kilowatts. For over 6 weeks during the winter. Now that would end up without the glacier shifting all of that back earlier into the fall and late summer, and would directly impact our ability to have programming and things of that nature up here. One thing that should be said is we're not as fantastic or pure as people like to believe up here in Holden Village. Electricity.
Looks like we're very pure.
No.
Holy, holy, holy.
Electricity is one of four forms of energy that we use up here. The others being diesel, wood, and propane. And the way we get through the fall and early spring season now, and the way we get through the winter, is we use as much electricity as we can, because it's our cleanest, cheapest source of electricity, or energy. But eventually the heating is supplemented by either diesel or wood burning, which obviously directly impacts the atmosphere and contributes to the greenhouse effect. And then the other form is propane, which is used in the kitchen for cooking and things like that, and also in the pottery kiln. So kind of ironically, without the glaciers, we would become increasingly dependent upon burning wood and diesel and screwing up the ecosystem further, almost a self-feeding thing. And beyond the direct impact, it's definitely the glaciers are part of the quality of life here. I can't imagine, somebody mentioned it just came down from Baldwin Lake, where you look at Mary Green Glacier hanging on the side of Bonanza Peak, but it's also part of our cool evenings here is that air masses move down across the glaciers. And I would see it having impact outside the village. I'm not a hydraulic engineer, but it's got to affect the runoff for irrigation for farmers and tourism and various other industries as much as people might want to ignore it or say that it's something we can give up.
I mean, I'm not an engineer or a scientist. I'm a person who's trying, after 70 years of thinking, to somehow speak for Earth and to listen to Earth and hear what Earth is going through. And when I listened again to your thing today, the CO, the carbon dioxide is going to increase and double. The more I listen, the more of the suffering of Earth that I hear, the unbelievable pains of Earth. And Romans 8 always comes to mind. But just one thought, if we're talking about where we might go with some of this, it seems to me that if I were a pastor of a congregation, and I was for a while last year, one of the first things I did was to say, make sure that every worship service was conscious, not just of humans and God, but of creation. And that if you're going to have a confession of sins, I did something wrong, the community did something wrong, and we did something wrong with the earth. Our confession needs to be not simply about what we've done to people, but it needs to be a confession. We have been part of the CO2 increase. We have been part of all those wrongs that have wounded and injured the earth. And I believe that unless our worship begins to reflect our consciousness of this wrong, we will really not begin to drive different cars or do different things. And so I would like to put just one appeal in that whenever you go back to your congregation, you think about how you might, in fact, incorporate concern for the suffering of Earth in your worship.
I'm Terry. I'm an environmental engineer, and I practice in both Washington and Oregon, an environmental engineer. And I deal primarily with water issues and environmental issues. And I guess I'm trying to relate to Phil's whole topic of global warming and how it would impact our water resources environment. You know, Phil was talking about having less water in the summer, and summer is the critical period for water in the Pacific Northwest because those are our low water periods. There's a high amount of competition for water between irrigation, municipal water supplies, the fisheries to a lesser extent because there still needs to be areas for spawning and rearing in the summer, but it's not the migration periods for most of the anadromous fish. But they're all integrated, and there's an enormous amount of competition for water. And summer is that period where there's a high degree of competition. And by saying that we'll have less water in the winter or in the summer period, that means that there's going to be even greater competition for that water. I guess the things that I see happening is our water systems are highly regulated to begin with, so there aren't any really natural water cycles except when you get up here into Holden. You don't have any regulation of the water before it comes through here. But in most of us, our water supplies are regulated by some dam system along, especially in the Pacific Northwest, whether it be along the Columbia system, the Snake system, or in Oregon, somewhere along the Willamette system. Can't remember how many dams. My husband can tell you how many dams there are on the Willamette, but how many? 19. So, you know, it's a highly regulated system, and I guess with less water, that just means maybe changing how that regulation, but it just means much higher competition for water along all those systems. State of Oregon currently has, I guess since the beginning of time, it's called first of right water rights, and that means the person that put their claim to it first, no matter how important their claim is, they're the ones that get to take water out of the river first. And that's what you call Western water law. There's a lot of movement on changing that, but I guess that's probably the biggest thing that impacts all of us is that competition for water. And I could probably go on for a couple hours about things that you could do to change the way that how you impact the water. But one thing I thought about in Holden, you know, other than a lot of the conservation things, one of the things of the future is pharmaceuticals in the water, in your wastewater. Right now, there currently aren't any technologies to take any of the pharmaceuticals out of the wastewater stream. We're just finding out, USGS right now has a study that's been going on for a couple of years now on seeing what those levels are. But, you know, you think of all the prescription and non-prescription drugs that all of us take on a daily basis.
Caffeine.
And those, and caffeine is actually one of the biggest ones, you're right, Roger. Caffeine is one of the biggest, and one of the bigger impactors is steroids. All the steroids that the human population takes, and they're looking at how that impacts the environment. So, you know, that's something that we're not even thinking about yet that goes way beyond and doesn't really apply to the global environment. But, you know, I guess my point being is that everything we do impacts the environment, and we don't even think of some of those far-reaching things like how we take prescription drugs and how they reach the environment.
Dumb question. How does steroids get in the water?
We all go to the bathroom, and it gets into the wastewater treatment plant, and the treatment, there is not a treatment that takes out those things. And caffeine is one of the highest things that's being found. All the caffeine that all of us drink is just goes straight through. We don't metabolize them.
It's good sewage alcohol. Okay, thanks for that, Scary.
Also my Starbucks
stuff. Bill, what are you driving these days?
Well, I usually ride my bike to work. I'm going to take off my scientist hat and just be a civilian for a minute. And I have to say that I'm reading three books up here that sort of pertain broadly to this theme. One of them is The Carbon War, which is a fascinating read. And I'm just incensed that 15 years ago, the scientists had a pretty good case about what was going to happen. And Margaret Thatcher got it, several world leaders got it, but the oil industry and the coal industry have consistently blocked progress.
Absolutely.
Both nationally and internationally. And it's against the will of the American people. 70% of Americans believe the essential science that I've laid out. About 60% of them, including a majority of Republicans, believe that we should be doing something about it. Various members of Congress have introduced very modest little mini pieces of action, and none of it's made it out of committee.
Excuse
me?
Said you're not surprised.
I'm not surprised, but I am incensed, because scientists have made it amply clear that even though we don't have all the details worked out, we know enough to start acting. There's this huge threat that of all sorts of terrible things happening to our descendants, and we're doing nothing about it, really. And we look at how our nation addresses other threats of unknown bad things happening. And the uncertainty about what bad things might happen is a reason to spend a lot of resources. And yet, in this case, where you have a much better idea of what's going to happen, uncertainty is trotted out as, well, a reason not to do anything. And
don't expect the Bush administration to do anything.
Well, Clinton actually wasn't a whole lot better.
Clinton what?
Was not a whole lot better. He had it in his head that he was going to do something, but he didn't stake any political capital on it. He didn't even... I mean, he did a lot of very modest good things, but they were easy, and he didn't stake much political capital on this. So I don't know, but you know, we elect politicians, and who are we electing? We're electing people who don't talk about this issue, by and large, because it's always down about number 8 or 10 or 12 on people's lists of the most important things, and barring some catastrophe that makes people think they really have to do something. Most politicians are not going to risk their next election on some long-term pie-in-the-sky issue like this. But, you know, ultimately, this is a democracy. If the people lead, the leaders will follow.
Well, you know...
Thank you. Let's just hear from Rich a second. Okay.
My name's Rich Armisen, and... a lot of my comments are about how we make decisions, and we all want to make good decisions, but my comments are from my, a fair chunk of my career was in the electric utility industry, and I worked with organizations like the Bonneville Power, Seattle City Light, and a few others, and in mostly in conservation, energy efficiency, and When working with these electric utilities and these utilities working with their customers, helping them to get energy efficiency projects implemented in their facilities, so much of the thought process is on economics. You know, how does it directly affect me? That's, you know, and which is a good thing. I mean, we all want to make those good decisions. We all want to make the dollar as effective as possible. So I can understand that. The problem is partly is how I see it, is that our economy, you know, has a lot of other hidden things in it, you know, where we, you know, buy oil from the Mideast, and somehow some of the cost of that is really part of our tax base. You know, we're not really paying the true cost of the oil, for example. Anyway, the point is, when it gets down to the environment, when we do energy efficiency opportunities, and let's say that they're a good choice, when you make that choice, there's, you know, the direct economic impacts to you, okay, the consumer. There are impacts to the industry that you're purchasing the goods from, and the contractors that are installing it and servicing it and whatnot. That helps support, you know, a whole giant infrastructure that takes an incredibly long amount of time to get up and going. And finally, there's something that in the industry, in the electric utility industry, we refer to as negative externalities. And those are things that you can't exactly quantify in economics. You know, these are the things like... the power generator that maybe it's a coal plant in Montana and it's generating electricity that we consume in, you know, Washington State. And it's awfully hard in Montana and maybe a few other states and maybe for the people around there, but, you know, it's the cheapest cost of power for your area. And, well, there it is. Negative externalities can also be closer to home. It can affect can affect your health, it can affect your neighbor's health, your region's health, you know, maybe it's health, maybe it's environmental, acid rains, which you don't think about until much later. The point is, when you make those decisions to buy an energy efficient whatever vehicle, or make a decision to maybe ride the bus more often instead of, you know, hopping the car, or maybe live closer to where you, you know, work or shop or whatever, those decisions are more than just the economics, you know, because the economics are distorted a bit in our nation, and partly in the world too. So.
Okay, thanks. All right, now let's hear from you and interact with people, whatever. Your name's Roger. Go ahead. What you were going to ask Bill or your comment?
Well, I was just going to make a comment that it's not only the very difficult issues like global warming, but just last year there was an opportunity for the Congress to extend the CAFE standards for cars and trucks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Corporate average fuel economy standards. Right. And right. Congress chose not to bring it out of committee. I mean,
and the National Academy of Sciences had said, you know, these are the benefits of raising CAFE standards, and this is, you know, they estimated the cost in human lives, and you know, it was a pretty compelling argument, and yeah, the auto industry has very effective lobbyists, and that's why it doesn't get out of control.
So maybe the question is then, should we as a church be doing something? Does your congregation do anything on this? Do churches get involved at a point where the government seems to fail? Or what does your Christian faith say about the global warming issue?
The church is green in America.
Becoming
you have
more
a green
so.
Party?
The National Council of Churches has taken a stand on a number of environmental issues, including the only one I really know about is climate change. But they have been starting to make noise. Our denomination, the Presbyterian Church USA, has also taken a public stand in favor of the Kyoto Protocol. And anything else to solve? Mm-hmm.
But what I found is that the stands that the church has taken aren't very public. I know that when the Snake River, you know, when the environmental impact statement came out on what should be done with Snake River dams, the Catholic Church wrote a very lengthy letter on what their stand was and what they thought should be done, and the same thing was done for John Day, and I'm sure beyond the bishop and the couple people that helped him draft that letter that there's wasn't a whole lot of understanding of what was going on, and I find that that's what's happening. The church might have a committee that puts together something, but people within the church aren't aware of what the church's stand on these environmental issues are. And if it is at the synod level, it's not making it down to the congregations.
Well, I would say, I'm going to say something, but as a seminary professor at the school where I work, in the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, we have a very strong green zone committee, and our seminary offers what we call an environmental emphasis that a student will have.
You going to share that?
Yeah.
Are you taking orders?
that our students can get. But it's interesting that parishes don't seem to want pastors who have an environmental emphasis certificate. Or one of my students shared, well, Becca, or you know her, that she finally did get a call to a congregation, but they were actually initially a little bit suspicious that she had done all this environmental work while at the seminary, and they called her in spite of that. They liked her anyway. So, what would you like to see your churches doing, or what motivates you?
Well, we live in California, and I think we do some incredibly stupid things. For instance, we water grass, and then we pay somebody to cut it, and somebody else who's driving a truck to haul the grass away. And
absolutely.
You know, the cycle just the cycle just keeps going on and on. And I respect my neighbors who have just rock front yards, and they maybe are growing some cacti or whatever, but...
Well, the natural environment is a dry environment.
Mm-hmm.
But all the people have moved out from Minnesota and Iowa and green country, and they wanted to reclaim it.
And I asked Spiller earlier this evening if he thought the use of fossil fuels was immoral, and he said, well, what do you think? And I said, yes, I think it is immoral, and that we should use, you know, less and less and less of fossil fuels if we can possibly do it.
Well, you know, fuel cell cars are in the process of being developed right now, and they're not doing it at a very fast rate. I work with Toyota, and Toyota said that they plan on rolling out one of the first ones in the next 10 years, but there's no regulatory push for that. They could push it out much quicker than that, but they're doing that just in the, you know, what they feel economically would be a good move, but there's no push to do that.
What are they going to do when the fuel cell goes belly up? I mean, a lot of people have been talking about, you know, batteries instead of, or fuel cells or something like that, instead of gasoline. Fine. But then other people say, well, what happens with the batteries and the fuel cells? What do we do with them?
I think the technology they're developing is renewable fuel cells, so it's not something that you use the fuel cell up and then discard it. It's a renewable fuel cell.
Put hydrogen in and
Thank you.
What are you driving these days?
Charles.
Did anybody have a hybrid car?
It's expensive.
I looked at them and didn't get one because they're expensive and they're not quite tweaked yet.
Yeah.
They're the first model. Yeah. And I heard too many stories. My friend in California had one, got recalled, and he didn't have a car for a year. So, you know.
Well, the Honda now has a hybrid version of its Civic.
Oh, right. That's
so it's more
looking at, I guess, just the hybrid.
But Civic. They're still $20,000, which is an incredible investment.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of outraged because the American motor companies, I saw an article saying that they're coming out with a hybrid, but it's a half hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not at, you know, like they're not even trying to compete with the Japanese models. They're making a less of a hybrid. So it's a little better, but it's not as good as the Japanese models, you know, or they might put a little hybrid in to get your SUVs from 14 miles per gallon up to 16 miles per gallon, you know, like, ooh la la. And it's sad that the American motor companies aren't making that effort that the Japanese are, you know. It's just depressing. If they have the technology, do it.
Dan or Karen, do you want to say anything about your hybrid? What it's like?
Well, it's really a pretty dream.
What is it?
It's a Prius. We've had it about 3 weeks.
Oh,
so when we drove here to Boulder, we got 50 miles per gallon.
Did you have a
hand? I did. I live in Western Montana, and I feel like I come almost from a different planet in part because we live in, Gail can maybe support me in this, we live in an area in which we hear about the war on the West all the time and about multiple use issues. It's very conservative. And there is a perception that environmentalists do not care about the little person, that they no longer have a conscience, that they're interested in the big issues and the small people who are put out of work, who you know, who are going to lose their jobs because of these changes that, and I don't support that, but I do know and I hear that pain in communities that are losing their jobs because of logging, because of water being shut off in Klamath, Oregon. And I was thinking about when you were talking with Terry about water issues, that environmental concerns about fish are going to go real down on a list when people start not being able to farm or not having water to run out of their water faucets. And so we can talk about how our legislators don't pass legislation and think, what are they thinking? But they're hearing from those folks as well. It's not just they're getting money from, Ford Motor Company or Exxon Gas or what. It's also they're hearing from their constituents who are saying, don't forget about me, and what you're doing is going to hurt me. I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to not be able to farm. So it's not as simple as we just need to, you know, make sure Exxon doesn't give them X amount of dollars and they're going to see the light and do the right thing. It's much more complicated.
It's actually who has the strongest lobby. It really has nothing to do with the farmer down on his farm saying that he has a concern.
It has
totally to do with lobbies, and the environmentalists have just as strong the lobbies now, or they're getting just as strong as the farmers and as the timber industry and things like that. And those are the things we're seeing happen in Washington, Oregon, Idaho.
And what's one of the most subsidized industries around? Agriculture.
Agriculture.
Absolutely.
I still maintain that there is a sense that a lot of people have that they're being left out of the equation. And I think we hear it a lot where we live, a lot.
And global warming would be attached to that other laundry list of environmental
stuff. Exactly.
Even though that's
absolutely. Absolutely. And even though it doesn't have to make sense. It just has to have a green look to it. That's it.
So what would you suggest?
Personally, I think it's education. I think, although we get, it bothers me when I hear these little blips on the media about, like you were talking about, the high numbers are the only thing that they pick up. Somehow, we have to make people believe that this is real, because there are a lot of people who don't believe this is real. I know you said polls say 70%. Well, I live with a 30%. Yeah. This is a lie, and it's a plot. And, and you can discount them and say, okay, we don't need to deal with them because they're the minority. But they're being impacted, and we do as Christians have to educate them, make them understand it's in their best interest as well.
If you want an education of sorts, you should listen to the radio in Eastern Washington.
Well, that's the kind of radio I'm talking about. Yeah. Exactly.
Environmentalists are green Nazis.
Oh, green Nazis.
What?
Yeah. Green Nazis.
What?
Yeah. What they're labeled as.
Well, I remember you had it in Montana. The signs, we went in somewhere to buy a Coke or whatever while we were driving, and there's a big sign, if you're a Sierra Club member, you're not allowed in here. And I thought, well, I better hide my Sierra Club card. But I remember thinking, it was a logging community, and obviously they're thinking of people who chain themselves to trees. And I've been to I'm no longer a Sierra Club member, because I went to some Sierra Club meetings in San Antonio and said, what a bunch of expletive. And, I will never go back to a Sierra Club meeting in San Antonio. What a bunch of idiots. Oh my God. Bad science, bad logic, bad everything. And they were the most fanatical weirdos I've ever met in my life, and didn't have it. And if those are the kinds of people who are going to the logging places and talking, then, well, no wonder they hate them. I mean, they really don't care if those people lose their jobs. These people that at the meeting I was at, they don't care if they lose their jobs. They don't care if they lose their homes. They don't care if the whole town goes out of business, as long as the trees are still there. Mm-hmm. And so there's a definite, I can see how they feel
thing,
that
though,
way.
Excuse me. I come from North Dakota. There's not very many environmentalists there. Lots of farmers, lots of deserts. I mean, dirt blowing, rivers full of mud. I come out here and I am seriously thankful for some of these environmentalists that have saved this country.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible.
Absolutely. Do you ever want to eat dinner
now? Yeah. Yeah, being from North Dakota, some of the Montana and North Dakota folks are similar thinking. You know, economic, our recently elected governor put energy and environment as one of six topics in his the new economy for North Dakota. You know, energy and environment are one of the topics. There's tourism and other things, and further development of coal fits into that category. You know, and there's some interest in wind, but I just sort of by contrast, North Dakota is, you know, about 600,000 people, and the country of Iceland has a few more than that, less than a million. And Iceland made a decision recently to go to hydrogen economy. So between geothermal and hydrogen fuel cells, it'll be self-sustaining. And I'm not quite sure, you know, if it's wind or tide or what exactly they're. Some ideas on how to create the hydrogen there. But you know, a very similar sized population to our state just made the decision to be clean like that, and the resistance to that in North Dakota,
another country is Costa Rica has just elected a green government,
mm-hmm.
and there will be no fossil, no oil mining,
mm-hmm.
and the same kind of process is happening. Mm-hmm. And the government is totally green in its orientation, so it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the farms in Australia, one of the things that's happened in the last few years is that farmers have become advocates of tree planting, and they'll take a section of their farm, and so you have trees being planted all over the country in the farms. And the farming lobby has become part of one of the side aspects of environmental law.
I'm aware of churches that are doing things to really walk the walk and demonstrate their concern for the earth, ranging from supporting farmers markets that would support local farmers as opposed to agribusiness, and buying fair trade, free trade coffee to serve after worship services. Things like that. But I wanted to mention one that really relates to global warming that I'm aware of, and I'm a little hazy on the details, and you can help me. And that's an operation called Episcopal Power and Light that operated in California for a while. Maybe some of the rest of you have heard of it. Back when, I'm hazy on the details here, but California had a really deregulated energy industry, and that posed all sorts of problems later on. But one of the things that allowed organizations to do was to coalesce to develop their own and purchase their own sources of power. Episcopal Power and Light bought all of their power. All the power they acquired was from renewables, and churches could sign up for this and get their electricity from it. Is this, do you remember any more about it? Yeah, and unfortunately, when they it was one of the casualties of the move to rein in deregulation of the energy industry in California. And, so that's I'd be interested in hearing more about examples of things that congregations and individuals can do.
Dan, do you have one of those?
Yeah, well, I just would add this. I mean, we subscribe, I think it's Environmental Defense and their newsletters. And there's more and more examples of environmentalists working with ranchers, farmers, property owners who know that the future of their land is dependent on taking care of it. And I've just read positive stories about working together with the local people for the benefit of all. And I just wonder from many on the panel if they've heard more about this. I know the Bush administration in energy development is just I mean, in opening up energy development, it's just ruining some valleys in Colorado, and it's the local people now that are joining with the environmentalists to save their land, and I think it's a positive. But,
well, I mean, there's a lot of, like, Oregon Water Trusts and most of the environmental groups are buying up land along the you know, creeks and streams and rivers in order to create stream buffers so that, you know, there's not degradation of the stream and so that you can lower temperatures and also increase the health of the stream. So a lot of that is taking place, but I think it's taking place where it benefits economically. Like the water trust buys up water rights to put the water back in the stream, and most of the cases that's happening, it's an unused water right, and the farmer's making some money off of selling his water right. The other example is of really large farms are really, they're seeing that they need to be proactive in how they manage their farms environmentally. But it's more rare that you're going to see the small farmers doing an awful lot of that yet, unless they personally have, because it's not economically feasible for them to do that.
Rich, you wanted to?
A couple of comments. One was about the deregulation, or what really is re-regulation with some more relaxed rules. Back in 92, I think it was 92, policy went into effect, and what it meant for my industry, which is the energy efficiency industry that I was part of, was that literally thousands of people sort of migrated out of that industry because it stripped the ability for utilities to plan in a long-term way to implement grand projects. Okay, utility industries now are very focused. They're very myopic. You know, they're looking. You know, we used to look 20 years out, or longer. But you know, 20 years out. You know, you're lucky if you can get 5 years. You know, in a real plan from an electric utility. Okay, the energy efficiency was pretty well stripped out from most of those utilities' plans in any sort of major, you know, way. You know, there's a lot of utilities that are different, like Seattle City Live is an example. But, so that has had an effect. The other thing I should want to mention is when you see, like say, an electric utility market green power, okay, have sort of a wary eye when you look at it and ask some tough questions. Don't take it at face value, because this is the most typical thing that'll happen. First thing that they'll do is they'll repackage the green power that they already have in their portfolio, and they'll pull it out of their base, okay, and they'll say, oh, we've got green power, and we're gonna, you know, it'll cost you, you know, 30% more or whatever the premium is, and but then you can say to your friends and neighbors, you know, all my power is, you know, from this windmill. That isn't exactly how it works. So if you are, you know, wanting to participate in those programs, you know, make sure that all the press them for. Making sure that those are new resources that they're putting online because of the program, not just repackaging the old stuff. You know, that they got. I mean, I'm glad that they have the old stuff. You know, they're going to keep selling it, you know, whether you're in the program or not, because it's already in their infrastructure. But just, you know, that's the only way that it's really going to build up is if you press for the new resources that are coming online.
What?
Thanks. Phil, can I ask you, what, when you go out speaking, what do you meet groups like from North Dakota or Western Montana, I mean, the, or Eastern Washington? I mean, we all get newsletters from Eastern Washington that live here, spend time here. What, how do you work with people like that?
Mark is believe that.
How do you build alliances?
Very carefully.
Green Nazis.
Well, let's see. It really depends on the goals that I have, and since much of what we're trying to do is to get the region to prepare for what we've already committed ourselves to, I don't tend to do the advocacy professionally. And so I tend to speak more in terms of risk management and things like that, which they can, you know, no matter what political stripes they are, they can understand risk management. Even if they don't believe climate change, it's still a threat that's out there. But there's recently been some opinion research done on how to present climate change as an issue that people can actually move forward on. And what they suggest is that with any issue, you start by invoking commonly held values, responsibility, conservative use of resources, passing things on to the next generation, and so on. And once you kind of activate these good feelings that people have for these big concepts, then you move down into, well, the polluter should pay, it's not right for somebody to mess up the environment and just leave that for somebody else to clean up. And then finally, at the end, then you talk about, well, there's one kind of pollution that stays around for a very long time and affects the whole world, and that's greenhouse gas pollution. And by going through that, you instead of starting out by arguing about the science, you are increasing the likelihood that, A, that people will come along with you as far as the perspective that you want to present. There are a whole bunch of hands up.
Okay, sorry, I was looking at you.
And I think Harry was going to say.
Yeah. Okay, Harry, you had your hand up first, then Carl, we'll go around
the side. I was just going to say, it's very easy to vilify Eastern Washington or GW or corporate America, but I really like the first question, as far as what can we do in churches do, what are you driving these days? Because, you know, how many SUVs are there in church parking lots? And what are these people, the 70% that acknowledge global warming, driving?
And
the public outcry, you know, a couple of years ago over gas prices. I mean, we have these big villains, but we as people in this country, just like with sweatshop clothing and whatever, end up reaping the benefits of these industries. And I'm not an environmental engineer, but I recall one figure, I thought I heard on the radio a bit ago, that if the CAFE numbers would have been accepted, just that one move, accepting the CAFE numbers and getting them instated, there was the potential to save more fossil fuels than are actually available on the North Slope of Alaska.
Wow.
And that's something without any companies or whatever that we could do by just opting not to play in that economy or participate.
Carla.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I just want to echo what Phil was saying. At the risk of sounding self-serving, a few of us founded an organization called Earth Ministry 10 years ago that precisely asked some of these questions, as well as the role of the church, particularly individuals, congregations, and their local communities. And so one of the things that I learned going out speaking and preaching on behalf of Earth Ministry was, if there was the adult ed or whatever gathering before the church service, I'd spend the first 20 minutes just asking, why are you here? And I would take notes. Find out the language they're using. Find out where their pain's coming from. Find out where their fear is. Find out where their anger is. Find out where, you know, their concerns are. Is it mainly
energy over, stream issues or salmon issues or the American diet or global warming, and find the place that the energy is in that community, and then begin to respond to that in their own language. And as I think you put so well, find a way to get into the heart song of that community and find out where their energy is and where their own values of spirituality and longings for God come in the midst of that. But I also I just want to do a pitch for Earth Ministry to say that it's an organization that's been around for 10 years and it's based in Seattle, but copies of Earth Letter out here. We've done a number of things at Holden over the years. Very own Dan Erlander has spoken a number of times.
And I think Michael Scott is going to teach
St. Francis Day. Mike
Scott. You've taught here. Yeah.
I've taught here a few times. And so the organization has specifically worked with congregations as their goal and trying to mine the riches of existing Christian theology, spirituality, liturgy, and so forth, as well as to really invite new midrash on the tradition and saying, okay, there are things that no other generation of Christians have asked. Let's pray and invite the guidance of the Holy Spirit. So we've got a number of curriculums and whatnot that we have. But one of the things that I think is the strongest piece of the way the community works is the colleague network, which links people in different congregations, bioregionally and nationally, so that you don't feel isolated in your little congregation or your little community. And that community of people who know one another and gather regularly. I guess the last thing I want to say too is I think one of the resistances in churches is that people get scared. It's exactly what you're saying in your homily tonight, Ann, which I really enjoy, which is they want to get back to normalcy, which is don't scare me too much. And so I think the church has to find a way to bring gospel up front and center around these things. Otherwise, you're just going to scare people back into denial. Their fear from learning some of the things that you, for example, a class like you presented today, unless that's done in a context of worship, and a community like this, it just scares the daylights out of people. And I think that's one of the reasons and one of the reasons a lot of people come to church. And if I learned anything in the years of doing this work is a part of us wants to be comforted. So make sure when you're doing this work in your congregations that there's gospel, that you preach a word of hope. However you can find a way to do that.
Well, I think this needs to be part of our stewardship. We are stewards of this earth. This is God's creation, so we need to take care of it. And that would be, I think that would be an approach we can take.
In fact, I'm the elder for stewardship at our church, and I have defined that to mean environmental stewardship as well as all the other usual means.
And the other problem is the threat's not immediate enough to get a critical political mass. And the example of that is the accounting debacles of the death of the last few months. The politicians react once people start squawking. And they push through this accounting reform act. Now, whether it really reforms things, we'll see. But the politicians react to us approaching them. Mm-hmm.
I hear over and over from congressional staffers, we want to move forward on this, but this just isn't an issue we're hearing from our constituents about. Mm-hmm. And quite beyond who's lobbying them, a genuine email or fax or letter from a genuine person really means a lot.
It's part of the problem that it's too global and not local enough.
It's more than that.
Too many economic implications.
Even when it's local, churches don't address it. I live in Davis, California. It is the politically correct capital of the Central Valley. And we have got a farmer's market. We got a toad tunnel, for God's sake. So all the toads get under the street. We have pollution in Davis. We have people who have been living on bottled water, courtesy of the University of California, who polluted their water system with radioactivity and a whole lot of other stuff. The University of California is also a big leader. It's just joined with North Ovo or whatever the hell they are to produce, you know, those monster crops, the genetically engineered stuff. And they're gonna go forward with that. Try to get a church in Davis to say anything just about that, for Pete's sake. And hey, you get up in the pulpit in the morning and 20 to 50% of your congregation is part of university management administration staff and professorial staff, and no minister is going to risk his or her job. That's really the bottom line. And, you know, hey, and the congregation doesn't really want to do anything to say that much about it either, as long as it's not really, you know, bothering them. As long as they're not living on bottled water. What the heck?
Okay, we got a couple hands here. Who else? Why don't I say we got about 10 more minutes. But, of course, the conversation we did after that, but we did try to end after an hour. So you have a hand up. I don't know your name.
Linda,
and you're Roger. Okay, what? Oh, you say your name and then make your comment. Great. Who else?
I was thinking in one of the other things that I've really keyed in on in your talks, Phil, is the we're in that part of the country that may warm a few degrees, but we're also in a part that we've seen, you know, really significant changes in the intensity of rainstorms over the last 5 years. Just this year we had, in the Red River Basin, 15-inch rain in Roseau in less than 24 hours. 12-inch rains, two of them a week apart, in Norman County. 15-inch rain, or 17-inch rain, I think it was, in Buxton. So, you know, like in today's talk, you had the projections for increased crop yields in Lake States and Great Plains or whatever. And I'm just curious how it seems to me that when sort of general statements like that come out in the reports, that sounds like a good thing. And I wonder if there's any sensitivity, if we know enough in making the models, and coming to those conclusions in the models, to take into account that, you know, there are townships that got flooded out. They have no crop. There's half a county with no crops. So, one question is, what do we need to do to sort of know more about how to come to conclusions, and then how to tie sort of looking at it regionally, if the Great Plains are both the coal center, a lot of coal mining, a lot of coal burning, and then sort of the suffering a lot of consequences on the climate side, that ought to become a big issue if those things are linked together, instead of investments in the coal development being the economic development tool, and then, farm policy to bail out, to answer the disasters, being another way to bring money into the region. And they just...
Certainly had a great mosquito crop with all that.
Yeah, there's been plenty of mosquitoes,
excellent,
yeah.
Excellent crop.
Tons to the acre. But it seems to me one of the real shortcomings of policy at state and national levels is that these things don't sort of tie together. You know, it's the climate issue is a completely different issue than, sort of the whole problem with cropping and disease and climate cycling. But
Then there's an interesting modeling project going on, so you know, hopefully we'll be able to use the modeling to show, to kind of run out scenarios and help the whole region learn a little bit about this. But it's, there are so few who are sort of interested in drawing those connections.
You know, it's hard for me to imagine doing much of anything at all because these are such huge problems. They're sort of distant. And how can we do something like that when we don't even seem to be able to deal with our own rampant materialism, which is driving some of these problems?
That's how everybody thinks.
That's, I know.
What can I do?
We don't do anything. And I drive a Volkswagen Passat, which gets about 32 miles to the gallon, and it's an ultra-low emissions vehicle. But buying that vehicle just adds to this materialist stuff, because...
Do you have some ideas up there?
Oh, go ahead. I just had heard California is about to pass, or I don't know if they have, emission standards that will force Detroit into getting cleaner cars, because so many cars are sold in California that even though they can't get it through the U.S. Congress, if California leads the way, Detroit has to follow. So hopefully that is passed, because I find that very hopeful that there is a door that's been opened to somehow force the decreasing use of fossil fuels.
Bill, what was the name of the book that you told us about 101 things?
Stormy Weather, 101 Ways to Solve Global Warming, or something like that.
And yeah, it's in the bookstore. The order
it is. Yeah, and if you're interested in looking for things that you can actually do, look in there. And if you don't want to look in the book, the one thing you can do that's very easy and will probably make a bigger difference than anything else is to write to your congressperson.
And get your friends to write to you.
Just a quick thing, too, in terms of what should hold on it. One of the things that's exciting to me is to think in terms of how many property holdings all our denominations have. Camp and conference centers. I mean, think of the Roman Catholic Church, I think of Buck Creek, Houston Center, Holden Village. Churches have a real opportunity in their land holdings to model something different. And I think Holden's been doing that for 40 years. You know, and having environment, peace and justice, spirituality, worship, all of them, not disconnecting those and asking questions like this in the first place. And so I think Holden's been a real model to what across the denominations church leadership can do with their property holdings, because it's not an insignificant amount of properties if you look at the mainline denominations. And so what can these camp and conference centers do to model some of what we're talking about? And there's actually a network of, you could ask Mike about that, of camp and conference centers interdenominationally asking precisely that question, because people come there. You know, they come there for their confirmation classes or their youth groups or whatever. And so, and I think Holden's been one of the leaders.
I think there's more to, can I just make comments? There's more to what churches can model than maybe just what Holden does. Just encouraging people, I mean, simple things like planting native species. I mean, in Seattle, there's a big movement towards planting native species to the Northwest, and that helps the salmon runs, you know, and that helps create wildlife habitat within the city. I mean, just little simple things like that make you think about what actions you do to your lawn affect, you know, the environment, fertilizers that you have to use, and all that water you use to keep your lawn green in the summer. And like sort of saying their church pays somebody to you know, grow the grass and mow the grass and haul the grass. I mean, you know, just to get, you know, to
you know, educate your parishioners just about just simple things you can do in your own home, you know, and I think that the church, I don't know, could just encourage that even on their own property. I worked at a Christian college that bought out this property, and they wanted to tear down this and tear down that, and they had a wetland, but they felt like they could mitigate it by building a pump to remove water and do all that. And I'm like, just let it be a wetland, for heaven's sake, and move the building you wanted to build, and just, you know, be good stewards of the land. Don't keep ripping it apart and doing more things that are going to change the landscape, you know, as it already had. But, you know, I don't know, just like people don't think about that. Like, it's always flooded. Just let it be wetland, you know, just let it be and stop tweaking it. And they could be a model to all their students and anybody who comes to the college that, as Christians, it is our steward. You know, they're stewards.
Overland College has anybody been to Overland College in the last 4 years to see their environmental?
That program.
Yeah. Incredible. Fantastic. They designed this building with a view towards sustainable building, meaning that it would be essentially self-sustaining. And so it's got solar panels in the roof. It generates a fair amount of its own electricity. Their goal is eventually to put as much electricity back into the grid as they take out of the grid. With solar panels, you know, you don't get electricity all the time. So the idea is to borrow some. But they have a wetland that they use as part of their sewer processing. And they pump water through there, and the little organisms in there absorb the waste, and then they get, you know, they get water back. And the whole idea extends to the landscaping. They've got native plants, many of which are edible.
Right.
So the idea is that you walk through these grounds, and you are connected with earth, and you're no longer sort of separated. But by eating the landscaping of this building, you're sort of reminded that we really are part of the earth. And I think it's a beautiful testament. I heard about this at the Presbyterians for Restoring Creation conference, and there are churches that are interested in doing the same kinds of things.
Well, I think I should say, one last word. Go ahead, Carrie.
I guess the thing that, and I guess especially as someone that deals in this every day, one of the most frustrating things for me is people that say they're very environmental conscious, but they're not doing the small things at home to take those first steps. The people that are writing letters and being real activists, but they still take a 30-minute shower, don't take that 5-minute shower, they're putting fertilizer, weed and feed on their lawn and things like that. So I know that quite a few years ago there was, I think, 50 things you can do to help the earth. You know, there's a lot of lists out there that are really simple things. And we can talk about how we can help global warming and things like that, but I guess as a first step, look at yourselves and your own lives and how you're doing things, and then bring that to your church, what improvements you've made, and then you bring that to the world. But you need to look at your own life and how you're doing things first.
All right, I need to see the medic. How's that? I'll just put it as I have an appointment with him to look at my leg in a few minutes. So, but let the conversation continue. Why don't I just say formally we can stop. If people want to quit after an hour, that's fine. Like, I have to go home. But you're welcome to stay. And I want to especially thank our distinguished panelists here and all of you. It's really
you're all distinguished.